Thank you for listening to Fund the People, a podcast with me, Rusty Stahl. For 20 years, I've supported leadership development for foundation and nonprofit professionals. In 2014, I started my organization, Fund the People, the national campaign to maximize investment in the nonprofit workforce. Now we've launched this podcast to amplify how and why philanthropy should invest in nonprofit people. Do you love nonprofit work, but find yourself frustrated by the starvation cycle, the overhead myth, the racial and economic inequity, and the toxic burnout culture that dampens our effectiveness? Do you want to see change, but you're not sure how to address these harmful, outdated mental models and practices, or what to replace them with? Then this is the podcast for you. Every episode, I sit down with fascinating thought leaders from across our sector to gather stories, research, and practical resources that you can use to ensure that nonprofit people are at the center of performance, impact, and sustainability in your organization or the organizations that you support. So let's dive in together as we learn how to fund the people. This episode is brought to you by Talent Justice. Talent Justice helps funders and nonprofits to invest in intersectional racial equity in the nonprofit workforce. You can find research, infographics, videos, tools, and more at talentjustice.org. Talent Justice is an initiative of Fund the People through a research partnership with CURE, the Center for Urban and Racial Equity. Talent Justice materials are part of the Fund the People toolkit and are available at no cost to the field. You can follow Talent Justice on Twitter at talent_justice or visit us online at talentjustice.org. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Fund the People podcast with me, Rusty Stahl. I'm excited to have you here for this bonus Inauguration Day episode. This week, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will be inaugurated as President and Vice President of these United States of America. Congratulations, Mr. President and Madam Vice President. Congratulations for waging a battle for the soul of the nation and for putting forward plans to build back better. The 12 million Americans who compose our nonprofit workforce are the trust engines that keep American communities humming. In so many ways, the soul of America lives outside the formal institutions of our representative democracy and outside the marketplace where we buy and sell products. The soul of America thrives in our civil society, the space between the market and the government, where people self-organize around community needs and to address visions for change. And that civil society relies upon the structures and organizations of the nonprofit sector. This is the space where so many of our clergy, our community health and public health workers, our social workers, our artists, our youth workers, our public intellectuals and educators, our community organizers, our climate change activists, our civil rights workers, human rights workers, voting rights workers. This is where so many crucial folks reside and do their work. So the battle for the soul of our nation is not just a battle about which party or person is in which seat of political power. It's also about sustaining and nourishing the embattled workers of the nonprofit community. To build back better, we need the Biden-Harris administration, the executive branch, the agencies and policymakers and regulators of the U.S. government to understand and support the role that nonprofit people play in our American system, in our American community. They need to understand the role we play in ending the pandemic, in restarting the economy, in stopping climate change, and in advancing racial equity. The nonprofit workforce has a crucial role in each of those critical areas. And the government needs to understand what we as nonprofit workers need in order to keep our jobs so we can do this important work. We need a partner in government who understands why it's critical for government to fund the people who power America's nonprofit sector. In that spirit, for this special Inauguration Day bonus episode of the podcast, I am pleased to have Dan Cardinelli join us. Dan is one of a very small handful of folks who can represent the power and needs of the nonprofit workforce and the nonprofit sector to the highest levels of folks in the government through the organization he leads, Independent Sector. And Dan joins us today to talk about how he and Independent Sector have been working with the Biden-Harris transition team and incoming administration to address the sector's needs and the potential we have to address the crises of our times. It's not miraculous. I think it's going to be a slow process, probably less than we want or need is what we'll get. But it's important to hear where things are and what's been happening. So I'm pleased to be able to bring this to you in this special bonus episode. I will be speaking to you again in late March when the podcast returns with season two of Fund the People. So enjoy the interview and I will speak to you then. Stay strong, stay safe, stay well. Welcome, everybody, to a special bonus episode of Fund the People, a podcast with me, Rusty Stahl. Happy to have you here in January 2020 as we recognize the inauguration of an incoming president and vice president and a new administration in the executive branch of the U.S. government. Pleased to be joined today by Dan Cardinelli. He's president and CEO of Independent Sector, the only national membership organization that brings together a diverse set of nonprofits, foundations, and corporations to advance the public good. Before joining Independent Sector, which many of us refer to as IS, in 2016, Dan served on the IS board of directors and several committees. And he led an organization that is a member of Independent Sector. It's called Communities in Schools, and it's the nation's largest and most effective dropout prevention organization. He led that for 12 years after working in other positions in the organization. And as a thought leader in the field of public education, Dan was credited with fostering the growing national trend toward community involvement in schools that could not be more relevant today, through partnerships with parents, businesses, policymakers, and nonprofits. As president and CEO of IS, he believes strongly in the power of nonprofits, foundations, and others to work collaboratively to improve life and the environment for individuals and communities around the world. And Dan is really known in the field for his commitment to performance management to drive evidence-based programs and high-impact organizations. So thank you so much for being here with me today, Dan.
Rusty, I'm delighted to be here, and just want to give a big shout out to you for your work and the importance of really talking about professional nonprofit staff being a real backbone to the health of the sector.
I appreciate it, and I think we're all just lucky to have groups like Independent Sector and Fund the People out there on behalf of so many thousands of nonprofits around the country doing important work. And I first got introduced to Independent Sector as a graduate student at Indiana University when I was studying with my mentor, Robert Payton, who had been, I guess, part of, you know, sort of that first cohort of researchers involved with IS, trying to create a research agenda for the sector. So and that, I think, was in the early 80s, not when I was a grad student, but when he was doing that. So it's good to feature your work and keep that work alive. I always start with asking folks a little bit about their own career journey, something beyond the bio. So would love to hear about a little bit about where you came from and how you've made your way through the sector.
Mine is probably not that atypical a journey, in that I started as a young man really through a faith-based institution, Catholic Church, where I really cut my teeth learning about community organizing and about social change. And I was, even a high school student, exposed to these nuns and priests and lay people working in the South Bronx. But then kind of launched me into a real interest in how communities could come together in ways that could solve their own problems and harness their own power to ensure that their needs were met on their own terms. And that kind of launched me into a period of time where I lived and worked in Latin America, working with the Catholic Church, and really trained as a community organizer and using analytic frameworks, this notion of social analysis, where I went to an institute in Guadalajara and I was trained as a community organizer. Came back to the States, had a fellowship at Georgetown, and then had a short stint at an international leadership training program through Partners of the Americas. And as you mentioned, spent the majority of my time, my career at communities and schools, which when I got there was this, you know, extraordinary organization of 200 plus local organizations, all doing kind of their own thing because they cared about kids. And what we were able to do collectively, not just me, but a whole group of people, was introduce the ability for that network to be more intentional about using analytics to understand what were the systems that held poor kids back, that tended to be brown and black in the United States, from being able to graduate with a real set of options around post-secondary attainment. So over a, you know, almost a 17-year period, that community, that network of nonprofits, kind of harnessed its own wisdom, used rigorous evaluation practices, and together brought an innovative practice to what we ended up codifying, something called integrated student supports, which, as you mentioned at the beginning, is the way communities actively partner with government by harnessing business and philanthropy and nonprofits to drive equity into public education, mitigating the effects of poverty and systemic racism in the design of public education so that every young person had a real shot at being his or her own agent to be able to make choices about how they wanted to work in the world. Apropos of this conversation, I'd say two things. You know, communities and schools is an excellent example of exactly what I think you have been leading at Fund the People. Two dimensions. One, in any given year, we're 3,500 to 4,500 professional staff across the country, mobilizing roughly 40 to 70,000 volunteers. So the professional staff are the backbone of the ability for a community to not have to have, you know, 70,000 professional staff, but pool those resources, those human resources, into an effective way to support a public institution, education, which, as you know, serves as the pipeline for the human capital strategy for the U.S., right? Public education is the driver into the business community. So it's a wonderful partnership. The second thing is, through philanthropic investments, we built a very, very hardcore professional credentialized staff that were rigorously trained in both how to run a nonprofit and how to deliver this evidence-based model that then showed that we, you know, categorically improved the outcomes we were aspiring for the young people that we worked with. So a highly trained professional workforce mobilizing a community set of resources and volunteers actually made a measurable difference by third-party evaluations in delivering high-quality opportunities for brown and black kids who were structurally held back and eventually had credibility to change public policy so that there was a structural corrective to the way public education was delivered. So it's a real proof point in, I think, what you at Fund the People are trying to do.
Yeah, and a very unusual, I think, in our field, blending together of that sort of data-based approach and sort of the technocratic end of the sector with that more community-based, community organizing, responsive approach. So really interesting that you've kind of blended those in your career. One thing I was mentioning to you before, I'd love for you to share with the audience, is how you sort of brought funders in as champions for what you needed. So one thing we talk about in our work is the need for organizations to have the flexible budget and capacity to support their staff and other functions as needed, and how cobbled together budgets tend to get with foundation, donor, government, and other kinds of restricted support. So I was curious if you could just touch on how you manage that tension.
It's a tricky line to walk always. So, you know, I came to communities and schools in the late 90s and then became the president in 2004. And so I lived through an era of the coming to life of strategic philanthropy. And I noticed during the development of strategic philanthropy, there was a great divide. One where there were funders like the Hewlett Foundation that really retained a deep commitment to general operating support in their strategic philanthropy model, where they really took the notion that you evaluated the strengths and weaknesses of organizations and their ability to drive an impact, and then you gave them the resources and get out of their way and walked with them in a coaching mode. And we had great examples of that, Edna McConnell Clark or Atlantic Philanthropies or the Robertson Foundation. There were really terrific examples. And then there was the other fork that seemed to go down the road is that philanthropy became their own almost operating nonprofit with their own theories of change. And they went to nonprofits as contractors to pick off very discrete pieces of work that tended to go towards very specific programmatic grants with the overhead caps and a high degree of control, and kind of ignoring in many regards the health of that organization, more interested in driving their theory. And it's not a judgment of them. It just is, as you learn and grow as a field change, this was my observation as a leader and a practitioner in the field. And so what I realized we were going to have to do is, one, identify those philanthropic partners who were highly aligned with what we were trying to get accomplished. So there was alignment of theory of change, and they believed in general operating. And then when we worked with the other group who were more kind of programmatic, we had to make sure whatever we went to them with was within our strategic framework. We didn't respond to their desire to work with us. We had lots of funders come to us and say, we want you to do this new project. And we would say, no, that's not kind of our core business. But if you'd like to fund X or Y that we're trying to get accomplished and there's alignment, then we will take a programmatic grant. That was a very successful strategy for us. And there were plenty of funders that came in. I'll never forget the AT&T Foundation, had to have much more direct line on their programmatic investment and what they delivered for their board. But they worked with us to really determine what were, in fact, our strategies and how we could collaborate in investing in kind of our overall general operating. And they just picked off pieces of it. So there are lots of ways to do it. But I will say this, and it was only when we became able to own our own expertise, and we did that in a way that was both about our own just self-assurance that we were good at what we did, and we used third-party evaluations as validators that were, in a sense, the coin of the realm for many of these strategic philanthropies. The downside of that, and then I'll shut up, is that what we were a part of, unintentionally, reinforcing structures that had built in inequity in the evaluation structure. Mm-hmm. And I think there's ways to reinterrogate and rebuild evaluation modalities which are highly respectful of equity and the dismantling of racism.
Yeah, I mean, we all are somehow playing these games to make it all work. And so the fact that you and your colleagues drew those lines around, these are our competencies, these are our needs, this is our approach, you know, will you join us? I think is such an important message for others who are in executive director or development roles. It's strategic fundraising.
Exactly.
I guess. Yeah. Speaking of, leaders in our sector, let's talk a little bit about what's been happening leading up to this inauguration in our sector. And so one thing, when I initially reached out to you for this interview, we hadn't had a rebellion on the U.S. Capitol yet. So,
right.
We did have, you know, a lot of challenges we'd faced as a sector. We had COVID, we had, you know, years and years of policy crises and other things. And so you all put out this Health of the Nonprofit Sector report, I guess, in October. So I wanted to have you share that with our listeners and talk about what you were trying to accomplish with the report and what they can look to the report to learn about.
The original thinking behind the report is when I came to independent sector, as you mentioned at the beginning, I was on the board and, you know, believed deeply in the sector. I think civil society in the U.S., as you well know, 1.5 million plus nonprofits, 12 million professional staff, 63 million volunteers, $1 trillion of economic impact, the third largest employer in the U.S. We are a crown jewel in the world and a force for this country's engine of democracy. So prior to our current circumstances, when I came in, I kept asking, well, how strong are we? You know, where is our strengths? Where are our weaknesses? And how does our public policy work strengthen the sector or protect where it needs to be shored up or intervene? And our team, who is just terrific, said, well, we have to go over here on human capital, and we'll go over there for, you know, kind of information on governance and advocacy or on financial resources. And I said, you know, I mean, there is no one place where we're all in agreement as sector leaders, that there is a kind of report card on just how well we're doing and what we should be concerned about. So I, as an actor, when I was leading communities and schools, didn't have a sense of whether, you know, how what I did strengthened or weakened the sector, right? So because of that, we then said, well, there must be something. So Alan Abramson, who I know you know, agreed to come in and do a sabbatical with us to do the really hardcore, you know, research and lit review to find out what was out there, and a whole series of interviews. And it was very clear that we needed this by practitioners, and it didn't exist. Mm-hmm. So then we spent another year developing what the framework should look like. So in October is the very 1.0 version. And I want to be super clear with you. And you'll see in the writing that we did when we launched it, is we don't see this as the be all and the end all. This is something that will evolve and get better. And we're looking for folks' feedback, good and bad, in order to make it better. In October, we launched this report that is broken up into four kind of critical areas. So we asked the question is, you know, how strong are the financial resources of the sector? How strong is the human capital? Something you would be very a great thought partner on. How strong is the leadership and governance of the sector? And how healthy is our policy and advocacy capacity? And so in the report, we give the best existing rigorous data, and it's quite uneven. Some places it's really good, and other places it's somewhat weak. And then we make a set of recommendations about what we need to continue to learn or what we might do to strengthen whatever the quadrant is. The one piece that I will say, because it may be on folks' hearts and minds, given that just this week the Edelman folks released, or last week they released their annual trust report for the world, that we actually partnered with Edelman on a subset of the report in the governance and leadership section. And we have a unique set of research there. It's the only unique piece of research we do. We pull from other researchers otherwise. And it really test how much Americans trust civil society. And we divide it by saying, how much do you trust philanthropy? And how much do you trust nonprofits? That information is actually quite interesting. And as we know, trust is a really kind of questioned characteristic in American society. And our sector, nonprofits and philanthropic institutions, have historically played an incredibly important role as a trust engine for communities. We, like everybody, are experiencing decreased amounts of trust. So it is something that the listeners should be paying attention to and concerned.
Boy, that is a huge issue. I like how you said we're trust engines, because we do, you know, we do create that social capital in communities.
Absolutely.
Not on behalf of our organizations, but for the benefit of the community itself. And when people aren't trusting nonprofits or civil society groups, that is a huge, huge detriment to the organizations and to what they do.
And to the very fabric of civil society. I mean, it is historically, right, we are the place, the one of the, if not the most trusted institutions. And interestingly, Edelman's report last week really make it clear that right now business is seen as really the most trusted institution. That media, government, and the civil society sector, nonprofits and philanthropy, there's a precipitous drop in the trust that folks have.
I have not seen that yet, so I have to take a look, and we'll find a link and put it in the show notes so people can find that as well. Okay, well, so that's great. So this is sort of, this report you put out in October is kind of a baseline for work going forward.
That's exactly
for sort
right.
of, yeah. And I know that in the time since then, IS has been involved with sort of a conversation with the incoming administration, the transition team, around how, what the relationship will be between the White House, the administration, and hopefully even beyond this administration, but the federal government, at least the executive branch, and the nonprofit sector. And so I'd love for you to share a little bit about what that looked like, that conversation with them, and what IS and friends put together. And I was, as I, you know, for clarity and transparency, I was able to represent Fund the People as one of many reviewers and inputters for this memo that you all produced. And so would love to share that. And it's up on your website. We'll put a link to that as well so people can read the memo, but would love to have you talk about both the process and the content.
Sure. And thank you for your smarts and the experience being put in service of refining the work. So just again, to kind of pull back for a second, what makes American civil society such a force for good is it's large and it's a deep and profound partner with government, also with business, and increasingly so. But in many, many, many cases, government, either directly or indirectly, is the main source of revenue. And we are, whether it's health and human services, arts and culture, environmental stewardship, think tanks, universities, the healthcare system, it goes on and on. We are a real extension of what in other countries is part of the social contract that's run by government. So civil society is a, the government would fail if civil society disappeared. It would have to build its own infrastructure or rebuild civil society. I've been at this a long time now, and what our observations were was that in the Bush administration, they configured how they were going to work with nonprofits and philanthropy one way, and under Obama, they configured it differently, built on and learned, but evolved and grew it. And then under Trump, similar, there was a very different way in which they did or didn't work with civil society. And what we have observing is that, and the searing motivation for the memo was to say to the transition team, you need to not make this episodic, depending on who is in the White House. There needs to be some permanency to the design in which the White House engages with civil society and how it then interfaces with the various agencies. And you need to think about putting some stability and some integrity into the design, and that you build and evolve that design over time. You don't keep kind of starting from scratch, is what a little bit we were feeling. So we went to members of the transition team that we knew and said, we've been thinking about this for a while. And they came back and said, we have too. A number of these folks were involved in engaging with the sector while they were in the Obama administration. They said, tell us what your best ideas are. And don't come with the design as much as tell us what is the ideal kind of quality of relationship. And so the memo was designed to be able to say, clearly this administration has four big priorities, right? COVID recovery, the economic recovery, racial justice, and the environmental climate change crisis. And so they said, you know, help us understand how civil society would be an intimate partner in solving that as you think about the design. Give us something real to hold on to. So that's what we did. And you were, again, one of the many skilled thought leaders that helped craft this. And so I think what we're looking for is some permanency within the kind of executive administration that works very, very, very collaboratively across all the agencies. So that the kind of executive branch and the agencies have a coordinated way of understanding how they are supporting civil society. And there is a core value that we're after, and it's this. So often, policymakers turn to civil society to implement the policies that they've, in a sense, in a vacuum, developed. And that is a role that we do play as implementers. As I mentioned earlier, we're kind of an extension in many cases of what government services could be. What we're advocating is that in civil society, this 12 million professional staff and 63 million volunteers, there is enormous wisdom and smarts about what the problems are and what are some of the best solutions and how those solutions are actually implemented, rather than somebody in Washington thinking this is the best way to implement it, who may never have dealt with it other than in graduate school. So we're asking for, you know, a standing way in which policymakers and civil society engage, not in the immediate, how do you implement this idea, but what's the formulation of the problem? What are the sets of solutions? And what would be the set of policies that would allow for this to scale with the right adaptability across the country, right? Which is what the federal government has to have a commitment to be able to do. So that's been really our mantra. And I have to say the Biden administration has been quite receptive, and they've also managed our expectations and saying, you know, if you haven't been paying attention, we'll make it really clear. The country is in a, you know, code red crisis. And so we've got to be able to, you know, attend to the overwhelmingly urgent set of problems while at the same time focusing on these very, very important structural things. So be patient, work with us, and stay in the mix. We got to pace this. And we've heard that loud and clear. So that's just to sum up. One way we've been working with the administration is specifically around a structural way in which civil society can engage, not just with the Biden administration, but administrations moving forward. The second thing we've been talking to them about is about the crisis that also the sector is experiencing, right? We've seen almost a million folks become unemployed in the nonprofit sector. We've seen the education sector, the healthcare sector, arts and education sector being devastated, right? And so we're looking for, as the administration puts together, you know, a relief package or a set of relief package, we're advocating very hard that the administration specifically attend to what the sector needs. And I'll give you just a concrete example. We saw in the Paycheck Protection Program that back in March and April, that we had to advocate along with others in the coalition that nonprofits were included in the Paycheck Protection Program. But precisely because there wasn't a structured way to engage the civil society, the way that Paycheck Protection Program got included in the overall PPP design, it went through the SBA, which really hurt very, very small nonprofits, made it very difficult for them to access the resources. And those tend to be organizations led by folks of color in community. It also precluded the very large nonprofits, over 500 employees. And so had there been an office, there would have been an ability to really head off and structure this in a way that the money could have flowed across the kind of complexity of the sector and been appropriate for it, rather than through the Small Business Administration, which did the best job they could, but they just weren't designed to work with nonprofits.
Thank you for laying out both the sort of structural way to engage and also the crisis that as the sector is experiencing it. It was, I think, maddening to me that the way everything was continues to be talked about by the government and media is as if there are no nonprofits or any institutions other than small businesses and governments, state and local governments. It's like everything else is invisible. And we were just a subpart of small businesses.
And what's interesting, I totally agree with you. If you ask any one of those people within a week's time, particularly in the non-COVID era, but you know, where do their kids go when they're not, are they in any kind of sports league? Do you go to any kind of religious institution during the course of a week? Might you be part of some community group in your neighborhood? I mean, it just, do you care? I mean, it sounds silly, but the sports leagues, right? They're just, nonprofits are the in the warp and woof, and yet we go so unnoticed or underappreciated. So I share your incredible angst about this.
Yeah, because the more, I mean, this is something we talked about with Lester Solomon on this podcast, was just the more invisible that the sector is, the less the policymakers, basically it's a reinforcing thing, right? Like the less they address our needs or issues or engage us in a meaningful way, the less visible we are and so on.
As you well know, we at Independent Sector, when I was telling you about the health of the sector, we had the four quadrants. The three make a lot of sense to folks, right? Oh, you know, yeah, we need people. We need them to be trained and volunteers and professional staff. And we need money, right? Got to keep the lights on and pay for programs. And we need a governing board, right? And we need, you know, we want ethical behavior. We want good governance. And we want leaders, both formal and informal, driving this work. But policy and advocacy is the fourth quadrant. And that's the one where we thought it was incredibly important for the very reason that you just mentioned, that we can kind of hem and haw that we're not paid attention to. But at the same time, we don't step up as an integral part of our work. I'll give you an example. When I ran communities and schools, as I mentioned, we had between 40 and 70,000 volunteers any given year. When I would have the conversation with them about advocating, they're like, no, no, Dan, you don't understand. I'm in this for the kids. I'm like, exactly. That means you have to like not just go and do mentoring, which is incredibly important, but sitting down with your local school board member and explain what you're learning and why this is important and why a partnership with whether it's, you know, any of the youth serving organizations in that community is critical. And they saw that as not integral to their work and why they did this. So we ourselves have some real work to do in educating folks that part of our values isn't just about program delivery, but about advocating.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I like how you put it earlier, that part of our value is not just implementing on behalf of our funders or on behalf of government, but also bringing intellectual capital, ideas, knowledge, trust, all of those assets that nonprofits have as such a strength to the table of policymaking, because we're not just vessels through which people can, you know, put money in and you get outcome A out, you know.
Exactly.
there's actual people and leadership and ideas at play, and that doesn't get engaged enough by government.
Totally agree.
So as we head towards the end of this segment here, I wanted to ask you, just stepping back from the specific memo and everything, a bit. Given where we are as a country and as a sector, what do you hope to see in the coming year, 4 years, around democracy? You know, what's the role of the sector in sort of rebuilding, building back better, if you want to put it that way, but just rebuilding our democracy, our economy, public health?
I'll answer it in a couple different ways. First of all, I wrote an article for Stanford Social Innovation Review about 6 weeks ago, called, you know, kind of the daily practice of democracy, and we'll send it to you so you can put it in the column. In there, I make a very central point to the role I think civil society, one of the many roles civil society can play, and that is that every single day, the knitting of the community that nonprofits do, whether they're entirely volunteer-led or led by a professional staff or some combination thereof, it is the how they are governed, how they use their resources, the trust they build, We know nonprofits at the local level still enjoy a very high degree of trust. And it is really being a part of the community and responsive to the needs that is the social capital that is beginning to fray apart. So we don't have to do these big fancy things. We just have to be fully ourselves and intentional about delivering on our missions in ways that are deeply responsive to kind of enhance the quality of life and the environment. So that's the simple answer. It doesn't have to be fancy and big. It just means showing up and doing your thing. Mm-hmm. On a more sophisticated level, you know, I think some important observations, if you look at Georgia, regardless of your political affiliation, and I'm quite serious about that, it is analytically true that nonprofits played a extraordinarily important role in getting the vote out. And so in a completely ethical and legal way, but they were out getting folks to use their voice and vote. So this is where we saw nonprofits actually playing a catalytic role in, you know, historic turnout in Georgia in a way that fully enfranchised as many folks in the state of Georgia as we've seen. And that's a really big deal. So there are very formal ways, whether you're, you know, a voter advocacy group or whether you're just a trusted organization saying, you know, you drop your kids off here every day, you come and get your blood work done once a week. Are you voting? Please vote. And we know that nonprofits across the country play an incredibly important role in helping folks believe democracy can and should work. So that's a second dimension. And then the final thing I would say is we know from, again, the most recent Edelman report that nonprofits, and particularly those that are in local communities, are a trusted source of information. So stewarding that trust that enables each individual to believe that their voice and their actions matter. So I mentioned to you at Communities and Schools, when a volunteer came to Communities and Schools, we had a highly trained professional staff that turned that desire to make a difference in a kid's life into a meaningful action that actually did. And that kind of gift to the community then gives folks faith in the institutions that make up society. And if once you trust a nonprofit, you're more likely to trust government and hold government accountable. So those are the kind of from the very concrete daily stuff to the more abstract that I think civil society can play an incredibly important role in the future of our democracy. Not to mention one last thing, facts. You've probably been paying attention to this as much as I have. Now, local news is primarily nonprofit news organizations. So they're fascinating. There's been a big shift. The Knight Foundation has done some great work on this, where in order to get local news, you're turning more and more to, you know, the nonprofits in your community that are news agencies, whether it's NPR or some other newspaper. So what's beautiful about that is it's not a for-profit entity. It's a board of community members stewarding the organization in service of truth that is trusted.
That's great. At first, I thought you were talking about local news on TV, and I was like, wait a minute, those aren't facts. Those are like little sensational human interest stories. But no, yes, my old hometown paper, the Philly Inquirer, is now part of a nonprofit instead of a for-profit. And I think that's an incredible trend, and it's so important. Personally, I think the future of work is nonprofit, and more news and health institutions ought to be nonprofit, not less, because there's something mission driven.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, you just that is mission driven instead of profit driven. And that's such a huge distinction.
So when a board of directors of a healthcare institution is thinking about running efficiently so that the profit that is made is turned back to the institution so it can serve more people, as opposed to put in the pockets of individuals, it gives you pause when you think about that. Wow, isn't that amazing that the 30-person board at the local hospital, if it's for profit, it's thinking about extracting profit, and it to running efficiently, so that those folks and their shareholders get enriched, versus the nonprofit hospital, which would be deeply similarly driven for efficiency, so that the profit that's made is turned back to extending services or paying, enabling folks that couldn't afford healthcare to have it a discounted or a free way. I mean, it really is a big deal, to your point. It's a big deal.
And it drives me crazy when people say, oh, there's no difference between nonprofits and for-profits except tax status. They're all businesses. And I mean, I think what you've just outlined is such a huge difference in motivation and incentive and thinking. So I'm very appreciative of you for being here today. I know you're in Florida, not Washington, but I know for me and everybody listening, we're all hoping that, you know, all our colleagues in Washington at independent sector and across the nonprofit sector are healthy and safe and not too locked down during this week. We appreciate all you're doing to lift up our sector in the nation's capital.
Thank you. I'm happy to say that I think this was long planned to be out of Washington this time, but Washington may be now the safest place on the planet, given what's going on there, at least for the time being. But I want to thank you for your work at Fund the People and this podcast. This is a phenomenal service to the sector. So thanks.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for your time, Dan. And I'll look forward to future conversations.
Same here, Rusty.
Be well. All right. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Fund the People, a podcast with me, Rusty Stahl, where we amplify how and why philanthropy should support the nonprofit workforce. For links to the resources that were mentioned in this episode, check out our show notes and more at fundthepeople.org/podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show. And if you enjoyed the episode or you're a regular listener, please share the podcast with your network or at least with one or two colleagues who you believe would find it valuable. Thanks for all you do every day for our community and our country through your nonprofit work. Stick with it, keep your tank full, and take care of one another.